This is episode number 13 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, May 17th, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Up for discussion this week, Microsoft claims free software is infringing its patents. The FTC blasts states' regulation of online real estate services, and Google prevails over Perfect 10 in an important copyright case. Joining me to discuss these topics is Tech Liberation Front contributor Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Jerry.
We also have two guests this week. Marka Blafkin is Vice President for Public Affairs at the Association for Public Technology. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
How's it going?
Doing well.
Also with us is Ryan Paul, a regular contributor to Ars Technica. Hey, Ryan.
Hello.
First up, we're going to talk about Microsoft, which apparently in an interview accused free software of patent infringement. So, Ryan, what happened here?
Well, Microsoft issued a public statement saying that the Linux desktop software stack, including the Linux kernel, various desktop software applications regarding relating to mail and office documents, infringe on over 230 of Microsoft's own patents. Obviously, this accusation has been met with a rather vocal response from the free and open source software community. Microsoft has not yet disclosed the nature of the patents in question, but the company expects to receive royalties from Linux distributors and could potentially begin suing if royalties are not provided. Now, obviously, since the nature of the patents hasn't been disclosed entirely, the claims are somewhat dubious, but it's certainly possible and likely on some level that at least Microsoft has at least some patents that are infringed by open source software. The question, though, is whether or not Microsoft has a strong enough case to be able to win in court or to be able to extract large royalties. And many in the open source community think no. The Open Invention Network issued a formal response saying that they are willing to use their rather sizable patent portfolio to defend Linux and open source technology. And Linus Torvalds himself, creator of the Linux kernel, believes that Microsoft's Windows operating system probably infringes on more patents than the Linux kernel.
So is this the beginning of a some sort of new initiatives or a new concerted effort by Microsoft?
Microsoft has been making somewhat similar claims since 2004, but this is the first time they've said that their patents have been infringed rather than patents in general. I don't think that Microsoft is going to start suing consumers just yet. I think that the real goal right now is to create uncertainty and confusion about Linux in the commercial market.
Mark, what do you think about this?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I really just don't get all the hullabaloo about this article. I mean, here's the real facts that, you know, I think everyone else has come to realize. One, Microsoft has spent billions investing in research and development and decided to protect those investments by, you know, acquiring thousands of patents on them. It believes that some of these are being infringed upon by Linux and other free software applications. And that's something up until recently that Stallman, the Free Software Foundation, and the Open Source Risk Management Group all agreed with. And whilst a lot of people, mainly non-lawyers, have questioned the validity of those patents, you know, you have companies like Samsung and Xerox, two of the world's largest patent holders, and also happen to have, you know, armies of IP lawyers, have decided to do the same thing Novell has done and take licenses on those patents for Linux. So I think the questions about the validity of the patents are a bit dubious myself. And, you know, I think what you've seen here is that Microsoft's hand was a little bit forced. You know, you have companies like IBM and Novell making millions, distributing their own versions of this free software with infringements in it, while still bringing patent lawsuits on other companies to bring in their own revenue on software patents. So it's just an issue where Microsoft had to act at some point. You know, and I completely agree with where Ryan was going, that Microsoft doesn't have any interest in going after consumers at this point. And where I would disagree is that, you know, while some of the intent might be to create some uncertainty about the patents in Linux and on a commercial side. I think it's more about bringing the commercial players in the open source world to the table to start having more real discussions about the cross licensing schemes that the rest of the industry has done for years and years. And I think that the difficulty is the GPL itself. You know, GPL v2 makes it very difficult for limited patent license terms in the same way that they're done in every single other industry, because you have to offer eternal sub licensability of those patents. But Microsoft has actually worked with Novell and come up with a workaround for that, and found this Novell deal to essentially create a type of patent cross-license agreement that still worked on GPL v2. GPL v3 is trying to prevent that from happening anymore. So what you're going to have is a very difficult situation where it's almost impossible for software patents and free software to live together in a peaceful way. And that's the intent of the Free Software Foundation. And that's going to make it difficult, not just for large companies like Microsoft, but also small companies like our member Astron.
I think that's the point. I think that free software people believe, and I think they're probably right, that software patents are incompatible with free software, because if you have a patent that applies to a piece of software, then you have to pay a royalty on that software, and that means obviously you can't give the software for free. If you have to pay a royalty for the privilege of using the software, mm-hmm. and then you distribute it for free, you become liable for patent infringement if the person you distribute the software to doesn't pay a royalty on that software. And many of these free software organizations don't have the infrastructure to apply for the thousands of patents it takes to get a cross-licensing agreement with Microsoft. So they're not going to be able to sign the sorts of agreements that, say, Microsoft might sign with IBM or Sun, where they just agree not to sue each other, because if, say, the Apache Foundation wants to get permission, Microsoft isn't just going to sign a cross-licensing agreement unless the Apache Foundation first gets a large number of their own patents.
Well, yes, if we're looking at simply cross-licensing styles of agreements, but Microsoft, I believe, has also made it known, and given their competitive situation in the world, is essentially required to open up those things to developers of all types at a reasonable and not non-discriminatory kind of rate. I mean, They've announced publicly that they're open for business and willing to license their patent portfolio. So it doesn't necessarily need to be the traditional IBM and Microsoft come to the table. We each have a million patents and we're going to agree not to sue each other kind of agreement.
But that's my point. If the Apache Foundation wants to give its product away for free, it can't pay a per copy license to Microsoft for the privilege of doing that. Obviously it can't be subsidizing its users, use of that software. And I don't think Microsoft would be satisfied with saying, well, we'll give it to free and then you can charge each individual Apache user, because the logistical overhead of Microsoft tracking down each user is not going to work. So what it does is it effectively makes it impossible to have software that's distributed without charge.
Well,
it requires that all software go through a commercial model.
I don't buy necessarily the argument that Microsoft is just trying to protect its intellectual property. If Microsoft cared about protecting its intellectual property, it would disclose the nature of the patents in question and allow free software developers to develop around them so that they wouldn't have to infringe Microsoft's intellectual property. And, although the GPL is inherently hostile to patents with very good reason, I still think it's entirely possible for cross-licensing agreements to take place. And if Microsoft were really serious about it, they'd be going to the OIN, they'd be going to the Linux Foundation, and they'd be opening those negotiations instead of just bandying threats.
My understanding is they actually have. I mean, if you look at the articles that have come out around the Novell deal, et cetera. It wasn't Novell wasn't the only person they were talking to, and you know, Red Hat gave us the I cannot confirm nor deny answer when asked about the negotiations they had on this issue. It's not as if they're just banding about threats. You know, it's obvious that they took more than a year to work on the Novell deal and probably have been talking to others during that entire time. So I think it's kind of disingenuous to suggest that, you know, they're just banding about threats. It seems like they've actually been reaching out to members of the community in the commercial space for more than a year.
So where can I go to look at the list of these patents? I mean, I use some free software, and so theoretically, according to Microsoft, I'm engaging in patent infringement. And I realize that Microsoft probably isn't going to sue me, but I still think that if you're going to accuse a community that's largely non-commercial of infringing patents, you should disclose to that community which patents you believe are infringing.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could also start with, you know, just searching the PTO site for Microsoft patents, but that would take a while.
Of them are very vague. I mean, there's 6,000 of them, and there's millions of lines of free software code. And I this is one of the reasons one of the comments that one of the Microsoft people made in the Fortune article was that this can't possibly be accidental infringement. There's too much infringement going on. But when you take the intersection of 6,000 patents and, you know, 10 million lines of free software code, it's perfectly plausible that most of this infringement is accidental. And it might be that if Microsoft went in an open way to, say, Linus Torvalds and said, here are the 50 patents that you're infringing, that he and his developers would get to work changing the kernel so that it no longer infringes those patents.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think you're right. I actually agree that Microsoft statement is probably not accurate and that there's a lot of infringement that is accidental. Completely agree. I think that is not, however, because, you know, when we're talking about patents, we're not talking about copyright and lines of code. We're talking about concepts. We're talking about specific features and the way that they're implemented. And when you get into that kind of thing, you know, the majority of open source software is an attempt to create, especially free software, is an attempt to recreate proprietary applications that already exist. So by definition, they're trying to reverse engineer or copy specific types of functionalities, and if those are patented, then they might not have bothered to look in the patent database whether or not they were patented, but they knew that they were trying to copy something.
All right, well, we're not going to solve the patent issue in this podcast anyway, so let's move on to our next topic, which is that the FTC has blasted state regulation of online real estate services. What does this mean, Mark?
Well, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, mainly because I've had a lot of experience with this recently as as someone who's shopping for a home here in the D.C. market, you know, and given the immense amount of new web-based resources at my disposal, including, you know, sites like Zillow, Trulia, and Craigslist, I thought I'd, you know, venture out, try it on my own, and see if I could save a few thousand dollars in the process.
What you're trying to do then is not get a real estate agent, try to do it yourself.
Exactly. Try to avoid the buyer side real estate agent.
Right.
And I was quickly disabused of that notion when I told a traditional real estate agent of my plan, who quickly replied that, yeah, that ain't going to happen. No listing agent is going to give up any of that 6%. So either I can get my agent and give he or she 3%, or give the entire 6% to the buyer's agent. Or the seller's agent who's selling the property and is going to act as the agent for both of us.
Because otherwise you wouldn't get what? You wouldn't get the listings of the actual properties or what?
Well, you would actually not be able, because the way that this works, the way that the real estate industry works is that the seller of a property makes an agreement with a real estate agent to sell it.
Right.
And that agreement usually includes the now sacrosanct 6% commission. It's up to the real estate agent to decide what to do with that. Traditionally, it's split between the seller agent and the buyer agent at the time of the final sale. So the question has always been, how does the real estate industry protect that 6% commission? in light of the ongoing efforts of the internet to disintermediate middlemen.
Right.
And, you know, the real estate world is under the same competitive price pressures from around the internet that have driven down the fees of stockbrokers and travel agents around the country. But realtors have been tweaking their internal rules and lobbied for special legislative favors to keep the internet from really affecting their commission rates in the same way that they've affected travel agents and stockbrokers. So this is really what has drawn the ire of the FTC and DOJ, and the DOJ is now actually suing realtors for anti-competitive conduct. You know, some of the key areas that they're looking at are the fact that they've lobbied and gotten rules or laws in several states which prevent realtors from even rebating some of that 6% to their clients. So it's actually illegal for them to say, here's 1% of the commission back to you. So they're, as a way to create some price competition among agents. Many states also have laws that mandate minimum service requirements that include things that aren't even relevant in the age of the internet and limit discount-based business models. And finally, you know, realtors have also made efforts to limit access to the multiple listing service from virtual realtors, et cetera, to really, again, keep competition out of the ranks. So, you know, from our point of view, you know, the realtors are free to choose whatever business model they want, but deliberate creation of regulatory and legal barriers to competition really has to be ended.
You know, I really haven't looked at Craigslist's section for sales of homes. I don't know if there even is one. I know there's rentals, and that's very popular on Craigslist, and I'm sure accounts for a large part of their traffic. So why hasn't there been a Web 2.0 company that just connects sellers with buyers of homes? Is it because you need licensing?
Well, there are. I mean, Craigslist actually is becoming a really interesting place for buying real estate. You know, I try to check it every day because, you know, there's actually, because of the changes in the market, you have, one, a lot of sellers who are trying to avoid giving away that 6% and are trying to sell directly through the internet, including using Craigslist. So they'll often put it on Craigslist for, you know, 2 to 3 weeks before they actually hire an agent to try and sell it for them. You also have one thing that I've noticed is that because of the bust in the market for condos here, is that a lot of investors have essentially bought pre-construction condos and you know, now are realizing that they can't afford, with the intent they bought them with the intention of flipping them, but now have realized that these condos are already worth less than they're supposed to pay, and they're going to have a really difficult time selling them later on. So they're trying to find ways out of it, and including, you know, offering, you know, paying $50,000 towards your closing costs. I mean, it's pretty incredible at this point. But you know, there's also been other alternatives. Zip Realty is one. Redfin is one that's based in the Seattle area, and the National Association of Realtors is making efforts to create problems for them in that business model. One of my colleagues, Steve DelBianco, was actually on 60 Minutes just this past weekend in a piece all about this issue. He was actually one of the founders of a company called eRealty, which attempted to essentially play that role of a Web 2.0 company several years ago, even before Web 2.0 was cool. And they ran into a really difficult situation with the realtors, where they were trying to do everything they could to play by the rules. But, you know, the National Association of Realtors decided that it's time to change the rules then if they were going to be able to play by the rules.
Tim, Ryan?
So help me understand a little bit more what the basic legal barrier is. I mean, let's say I'm a lawyer and I just want to help, you know, say I just start a website that's like Craigslist, and then buyers and sellers find each other, and then they just come to me to fill out the paperwork. Is that illegal because I'm acting as a realtor, or is it just that the hassle of dealing with it, people just aren't as interested in doing that?
Well, there's a couple of issues there, Tim, and it's a good question. One of which is that you would need there's a couple of services that try to just engage buyers and sellers together, but you know the thing that the realtors own, which is their crown jewel, is the multiple listing service, and that's the place where you find all the homes that you that are out there.
It's a database, basically.
It's a database of everything for sale, and it's a great database, and they protect it with their lives. The issue is that you need access to that to really drive consumers to your site often. I mean, there
it's just a network effect issue.
It's traditionally a network effect issue. But I don't think that's really the real problem, because I think that can be overcome by creating alternative listing services, et cetera. And if that might undercut the price of traditional realtors. The real issue in terms of actual competitive barriers is often the state laws, like the ones that require minimum service. So
right.
If some of those minimum service laws include things like creating signage and posting ads in the local newspaper, et cetera, things that our traditional agents do but probably aren't that important, and something that a guy based in Minnesota can't do for somebody in California, that's the real barrier that you run into.
Well, we'll keep our eye on that. So what the FCC's basically come out with a report against that, and the DOJ is suing the National Realtor Association?
Yes.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's move on. Finally, Tim, you're going to talk to us about Google, who prevailed over Perfect 10, which is, I guess, a triple X website. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. I believe they have a magazine as well. They,
excellent. I'll have to look at that.
Their concern is with people who take their copyrighted images and display them on illegally on their websites. And often these websites will also put Google AdSense ads next to the images and generate a little bit of revenue that way. And so Perfect 10 sued Google back in 2004, accusing them of copyright infringement because Google's search engine displays thumbnails of the pictures when you search for an image, and some of those thumbnails were thumbnails of copyrighted Perfect 10 images. Now, for people who are familiar with copyright law, the thing that immediately comes to mind is the 2003 decision of Kelly v. Arribasoft, which is the first case that ruled that thumbnails in search engines is an example of fair use, that if the thumbnails are small enough, that it's not a substitute for the original image, and so that you can search engines can include thumbnails without getting the permission of the copyright holder. And Perfect 10 attempted to distinguish that from their case in two ways. One was because of this AdSense issue where Google was theoretically making money off of these websites, and the other was the fact that Perfect 10 had this service apparently where you can download these pornographic images to your cell phone, and the resolution on those images is approximately the same as the resolution on the thumbnails, and so they were pitching the thumbnails on Google search engine as a competitor to their cell phone thumbnail service.
I really wonder how well their cell phone porn business is doing. I can't imagine people downloading these thumbnail sized God knows what. Okay.
Actually, there's statistics that show that cell phone pornography is an extremely powerful emerging market with generating a lot of revenue.
Wow. So maybe there was something here.
That was not in the record that I looked at in that decision. but what they did look at is they found that the number of people who had accessed the thumbnails of Perfect 10 images from a cell phone was, as far as anybody can tell, zero. So the argument that it's competing just didn't, in the real world, that didn't actually happen. And so, anyway, to get to the end of the story, the Ninth Circuit handed down a ruling yesterday rejecting both of those arguments, saying that basically if you have a transformative use, which they ruled in 2003, thumbnails are, that the fact that you have an incidental commercial component, that you have revenues from AdSense, or that you're competing with this basically unrelated service, does not override the fact that it is, in fact, a transformative use.
Tim,
and I think... What's that?
Sorry. Tim, would the decision have been different if Google does have AdSense ads on the search results page? Would that be a big difference?
It's not clear. I think there definitely would have been a closer case in that instance. I mean, the ruling does say that you are allowed to have a commercial component if it's transformative. And, I mean, I don't think anybody has challenged that it's okay to have ads next to text search results, and those use excerpts of copyrighted material as well.
Right.
So that is an unsettled issue. I do believe that Google has been very careful, both in its thumbnails and also in Google News, to avoid having
and Google Book Search too.
And that was actually the next thing I was going to mention. Is I think this case will be a wind in Google's sails with respect to the Google Book Search issue, because it's exactly the same issue. You have a case where they're using copyrighted material in a clearly transformative sense, and the publisher's primary argument in the Google Book Search case is that it might be transformative, but you're still doing it for commercial purposes, and so therefore that's not acceptable. And I think this case says pretty clearly that the fact that there's a commercial element to it doesn't necessarily override the fact that it's transformative and therefore fair.
I have a question. Yeah. I know that with most search engines, you can use like a box file or something like that to configure what a search engine can index on your website. So can't Perfect 10 essentially just set up a box file and then have Google not index their site?
Yeah, that's true.
If they feel like there's a problem there.
The problem is that third parties are posting pirated copies of these images. So Perfect 10 is already. In fact, their entire website is password protected, so they're already excluding Google from indexing their site. It's third parties who take illicit copies of these photos and put them online.
So, in essence, the book publishers have a weaker case here because Google is not taking third-party copies of books.
Well, maybe. Although, on the other hand, they do have the counter argument that that when you put something on the web, it's expected the sort of the assumption
right.
is that it's available for public use, whereas when you publish a book to a library, it's not as clear. So I think it could cut in either direction, but
right.
certainly this ruling very clearly undercuts the argument that the publishers would have liked to do, which is to cite this case as an example that if the company's making some money off of the fair use, then it's not likely to be a fair use.
Hey, Tim, quick question as well. In terms of the text ads, was that an issue in the Belgian newspaper case? Did they use the commercial aspect when they were going after Google?
You know, I did not look at that case in detail. I'm relatively certain that Google News Search does not display ads, at least on its front page, and I don't think also on its news site, precisely for that reason.
Yeah.
And that, I believe, that's something the U.S. courts have not looked at, precisely because Google has been so careful. I don't think that any of the domestic companies have felt that it would make sense to bring a challenge because they would probably lose given how careful Google was being about it.
Yeah, Google News does not display ads. In that case, it was a Belgian court that shut down the Belgian Google News website. So it really wasn't applying the same fair use factors that we use here in the States, I guess.
Gotcha.
Right, and yeah, the copyright law there could be completely different, so it's hard to say what the factors are.
And on the AdSense issue, so the AdSense issue that the court was looking at was actually AdSense ads that were on the third-party sites that were posting the infringing content, correct?
Yeah, this is something that I wish the court would have come down a little bit harder on, because the Google Image Search and AdSense are completely unrelated programs. Google could spin one of them off, and it would have no impact on the other program. And so to say that the same company owns two different products, one of which happens to have a fair use claim, and the other of which happens to make some money off of the infringing product. The example I used in the blog post I did a couple days ago is, you know, if Microsoft's search engine links to an infringing website that uses IIS, does that mean that they're liable because they're making money from? I mean, if you have a general use product that happens to occasionally be used for an infringing use, that's completely irrelevant to the question, in my opinion, of whether some unrelated product line is making a fair use claim.
I guess there'd be one potential downside to that, which would be if, because most Google AdSense ads, I believe, are context-based, they should be able to conceivably understand at least the basic content of whatever is next to that ad. So I guess you could make a case that Google should be able to know whether or not there is some infringing or be able to...
The court did discuss that. The problem is that these are images, and I assume these websites mostly don't say, here are some infringing perfect images. They're just porn, and so far our image recognition technology is not good enough that you would be able to distinguish which porn is owned by which copyright holders.
All right. So any idea if Perfect Tense is appealing this to the Supreme Court?
No. I mean, I can't imagine they'd win, because I think the Supreme Court has tended to be very friendly to fair use claims, but they might appeal it.
All right. Well, that's going to have to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. Thanks to Tim Lee, Mark Blafkin, and Ryan Paul. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for the show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. See you next time.